This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the things I enjoy about the end of the year is seeing what's on everyone's 10 best lists. Our film critic David Edelstein is here with his. David is also film critic for New York Magazine. Welcome, David, and thanks for bringing your 10 best list. But before you get to the dramatic reading of it, let's look at some of the trends and patterns of the year in film. The national obsessions this year were basically political and financial, the economy, the presidential campaign, the election of Obama, the final days of President Bush. I mean, movies take too long to be made to literally reflect all of that. But were there certain movies this year that you think reflected the larger obsessions of the country?
I don't think the economic catastrophe has hit yet, except in terms of the box office numbers of a lot of these movies, particularly the small ones. But you can see that we're in the eighth year of a particular administration. And I think in mainstream movies, what surprised me this year is that there's been a kind of a hip cynicism, even nihilism, that's descended on movies, both domestic and foreign, that clearly has a lot to do with our post-9/11 world and the sense that we've lost our power to change it and perhaps a lack of faith in our leaders. The Dark Knight, the most successful film of the year, is, bar none, the bleakest, most depressing superhero picture ever made. I don't want to, it's not different in kind. Batman has always been a vigilante outcast. But in this film, he's up against a system that is so corrupt and an enemy who is so motivelessly, malignantly, cynically nihilistic that he ends up illegally data mining an entire city, and he still comes up short. You know, this is a movie with it's no catharsis. The idealists all perish. Evil is barely overcome. The superhero slinks away, and people loved it. I mean, people gave me a hard time because I didn't. I don't know what that tells you. But we also had a post-9/11 giant monster movie, Cloverfield, that was shot with a handheld camera. The gimmick being we had no idea what the larger picture was or who was able to do anything. We were just running away with people who didn't want to be stomped. There was a Bond movie, Quantum of Solace, which was very entertaining, but it was also deeply cynical because Bond was no longer part of the establishment because the establishment was too cowardly and corrupt, and U.S. intelligence was in bed with this multi-tentacled, multinational conglomerate that installed dictators. And then there was Body of Lies with Leo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe, another movie about U.S. indifference to the fate of the Third World. Really, for hope, you had to look at Iron Man. Now, Iron Man came from the same place, but it did a little fantasy pirouette. The hero starts out as a ruthlessly exploitive international weapons manufacturer, but then he becomes Iron Man, and he becomes the savior of Afghan women and children, endangered by his weapons in the first place.
Well, mostly the action movies you've described were bleak and cynical. The common wisdom is that during hard times, people like escapist entertainment. Do you think that's proving to be true this time around?
No, it's surprising. The more escapist movies, I think people have felt that they're kind of weightless. With the bleak exception of Mamma Mia, which for some reason encouraged people this summer to remove part of their brain, and even our greatest animated blockbuster, WALL-E, was a kind of a dystopian vision. I mean, it scared Disney. Disney didn't even show it to critics until 3 days before it opened, and most of us thought it was a masterpiece. But it's set in a sort of post-apocalyptic world where humankind has lost all touch with what it means to be human.
And it's about environmental disaster, too.
It is. But it's about that, and it's about the deeper sort of existential disaster of losing touch with the natural world, with your own body, with your own sense of how you exist in the natural world.
Maybe it says something that one of the holiday films, Slumdog Millionaires, pretty bleak, too, except for the ending.
Well, Slumdog Millionaire is... Look, I know there are a lot of people who love that movie, and it's winning lots of prizes, and it's a dazzling piece of work. But it's a lie. It's a big lie from beginning to end. It sets something very cynical, which is who wants to be a millionaire? This prism, this materialistic, technological showbiz prism through which this young man relives the tragedies of his life. And then it kind of sweeps that aside in the end with this burst of Bollywood romanticism. So you leave the theater singing and dancing. It's a pretty remarkable sleight of hand. I'm surprised as many people fall for it as do. I enjoyed the singing and dancing, too. But I don't think it's a particularly profound movie.
I think for the past couple of years when we've done the year-end review in movies, you've pointed out that movies about Iraq did pretty badly at the box office. What about this year?
Yeah, it's turned out to be a dead end, and it's even deader this year. I think one of the reasons is the films haven't really captured our collective imaginations, in part because we don't want to hear about a war that we may be losing or a war in which we may be doing bad things. That's why I was so excited by a movie that's on my 10 best list this year. It's not American, and it's not about the Iraq War. It's called Waltz with Bashir. It's by Ari Folman, an Israeli director and animator. And it's also about soldiers having flashbacks to terrible things that they did in the war. But here, in such a way, this is not a literal-minded film. It opens up your imagination instead of shutting it down. It's about this 1982 massacre of Palestinians that the Israelis were bystanders of, and the whole gimmick is that they've repressed it. They, the protagonists of the film, you know, don't remember exactly what happened, and so it's all very psychoanalytic, and he uses realistic figures against surreal backdrops. He has a kind of a trance-like score that's mixed with classical and rock and roll. And that fluid boundary between documentary and fantasy, between the real and the surreal, takes something that's become very banal in movies and kind of lifts it to the level of myth.
I should mention that the director of the film, Ari Folman, will be our guest later in the show, and we'll be talking more about Waltz with Bashir. Now, as you pointed out earlier, The Dark Knight was very successful, probably the most successful film at the box office this year. I've seen it on a lot of 10 best lists, but you were one of the dissenters. You didn't like the film. What do you think audiences responded to in the film? Like, how much of it do you think was like the dark themes that you discussed? How much of it was due to Heath Ledger's performance and the fact that it was his final movie after his death?
I think all of it contributed. I think that, but one of the things that was interesting is my review. I apparently wrote the first negative review of the film to get out onto the internet. So I knocked the Rotten Tomatoes score from 100% to like 97 or something. And now I didn't do this deliberately. I mean, I'd written the review a week before, and if I had known, believe me, I'd have had them hold it 3 hours. I would have let David Denby take the heat or something. You know, I definitely did not want to be that guy, but I got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of abusive emails, and 99% of them were from people who hadn't seen the movie. So they were just so primed to love it that there was no way when they went in there that they weren't going to love it. And also they were rooting for Heath Ledger. Now, Heath Ledger's performance does add this almost eerily supernatural element to what you're watching, because he really does seem to be this demon from the netherworld who's returned. I mean, it's almost as if he's sitting beside you in the theater cackling. And there is something very exciting about that performance, because he is going on all cylinders. I think what depressed me about it was I would have been incredibly excited to see Heath Ledger after this movie, because I feel that all his life and his career, he struggled against this idea that he was this sort of bland, blonde leading man. And he really wanted to prove that he could transform. And having gone as far as I think he was humanly capable of going, I think he could have pulled back and relaxed a little bit more and given, you know, and really probably evolved into a great movie star. That's what breaks my heart about that performance.
Yeah. My guest is David Edelstein, Fresh Air's film critic, and we're reviewing the year in film. David, let's take a short break here, and then we'll get to your 10 best list and a couple of films that you particularly hated this year.
Oh, goody.
All right.
Oh, goody.
Very good. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our film critic, David Edelstein, who's also a film critic for New York Magazine. We're reviewing the year in film. And David, before we get to your 10 best list, I know there's a couple of movies that you dislike so much they actually made you angry. So I can't wait to hear what they are.
Well, the first is Michael Haneke's Funny Games. And this is a remake, a shot-for-shot remake of a movie he made in German 10 years ago. And it's so not nice he made it twice. It's a punishing movie about psychopaths who take a family hostage. And I'm going to spoil it. They kill them all. But they do it. They torture him and kill him over a period of 2 hours. And the whole time you think maybe they're going to get away. And people have written to me and said, you don't understand. In his punky, nihilistic way, Haneke is playing with the bourgeois conventions of cinema escapism. You just don't get that, you clot. And I get it. I just think it's idiotic, and I just don't want to sit there and be tortured for an hour and a half. A terrible movie. The other one is Australia, which is the Baz Luhrmann movie. This is a movie with a vast budget, a vast canvas, full of, would-be marvels, that shows that this filmmaker has no grasp whatsoever of how to tell a story in images. It's just random, spurious sensation and special effects thrown at you willy-nilly. It's such a shameless movie. You can't believe that the audience isn't laughing at it and that there are actually some critics who think it's a visionary work of art. Oy.
Did you like Baz Luhrmann's musical Moulin Rouge?
I thought Moulin Rouge was a travesty. I'm sorry. I thought it was all chopped to bits. You couldn't see any. There wasn't a single gesture that was allowed to happen uninterrupted. Movies like that and Mamma Mia, people think that they're dance movies. You never see a human body in motion. I mean, they're Cuisinart movies. They're movies in which miracles are cheap.
Okay, well, this is that moment when we get to the stirring recitation of your 10 best list. So,
oh, goody, goody.
Are we going to hear it in order of preference or just alphabetical order? What's the order here?
Well, I'm going to give it to you in order of preference.
Okay.
But I should warn you that there are 11, and it's not by design. It was because I made it up, and I published it, and then I forgot one. I forgot that one came out this year. So I'm cheating a little bit.
We're going to cut you a break on this one.
All right, thank you. All right. Here we go. Number one, Rachel Getting Married. Number two, Wall-E. Number three, Happy-Go-Lucky. Number four, Cadillac Records. Number five, The Class. Number six, Waltz with Bashir. Number seven, Shotgun Stories. Number eight, Kit Kittredge, American Girl. That's the one people won't believe. Number nine, Doubt. And number 10, Taxi to the Dark Side. And Trouble the Water. See, I forgot Taxi when I made up this year's list because it won the Oscar and had a screwed up release that made it unclear if it was 2007 or 2008.
Okay, so, Kit Kittredge, you said that's the one we wouldn't believe. Why not?
Yeah. Well, that's the one because it was a total flop when it opened. I mean, people, including me, didn't see it because it looked like a merchandising tie-in. But it's anything but escapist. It's set at the height of the Depression. It's about an adolescent girl played by Abigail Breslin who sets out to be a photojournalist. And get this, all around her, people, her friends, families are being evicted from their homes. And she ends up documenting the struggles of hobos and giving the lie to the conventional wisdom and actually solving a crime spree. And I'm not going to say it's a masterpiece. Parts of it look like a bad dinner theater production of Annie. But I was so enchanted by this movie, I literally cried with joy. Abigail Breslin is just luminous. And as the dad of 6 and 10-year-old girls, I think her kit is one of the greatest role models for kids in contemporary movies.
So it's a good family movie.
Oh, it's a great family movie. It's inspiring.
So when you look at your 10 best list, do any patterns jump up at you?
Well, yeah. I tend to accentuate the positive. I'm looking for hope. I'm looking for what our future president has called the audacity of hope. And Rachel Getting Married is a very funny movie. I've never seen a movie with that mixture of, on one hand, loss and desolation, and on the other, this overflowing warmth and fullness. Because the center story, remember the center story, a narcissistic drug addict heroine, Anne Hathaway, a horrific family tragedy, a dead little boy, a mother, played by Deborah Winger, who's emotionally stunted, sisters who barely speak, a broken home. And yet this is Jonathan Demme, this reflexive humanist, and he puts it all in the middle of this extended family in which these racial and cultural barriers are dissolving. And some people complain that, oh, God, the music goes on and on and the ceremony goes on. I thought it was great because, you know, even if this woman has to go back to rehab, when she gets out, there's still a chance she could get her act together and this world will be waiting that she can contribute something to and that will welcome her with open arms. And Happy-Go-Lucky, the Mike Leigh comedy, is a really good movie to think about alongside it because, again, we're faced with a worldview that could easily be utopian or fatuous. The heroine is a London school teacher, Poppy, played by Sally Hawkins, who is so effervescent, and she takes whatever comes with a smile and a quip. And you know, you're watching and you're thinking, boy, this woman is in for a dose of reality. And it by the end, you see, it's not simple-minded whimsy. It's a design for living that's brave and hard-won. And it's the kind of design we need if we're going to make any progress as a species.
I just have to say I'm all for the audacity of hope, but I find that main character in Happy-Go-Lucky really irritating. It's like she didn't.
Oh, you did.
It's like she didn't stop. She was always like talking or gesturing or being enthusiastic, or it just really got on my nerves.
Well, she was very, very childlike, and she was very bratty, and she was very irritating. And I know people who share that view, but we don't have to live life at her pitch to believe that somebody who tends to look at the bright side of things has a better chance without being blinded to the bad. And that's the interesting thing about her. It's not that she is a cockeyed optimist. Her eyes are actually very focused. Somebody who can maintain that level of buoyancy while also recognize the truth of and the ugliness in the world around her, that's another great role model.
Well, David, with the holidays coming up, well, at least many people will have a little bit of time for a movie or two. Is there a movie or two you'd like to recommend or a movie or two you'd like to recommend we stay away from?
Well, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button is interesting. It's based on an F. Scott Fitzgerald story about a guy who ages backwards. In other words, he's born an old man and he gets younger and younger and younger as he approaches infancy and death. And Brad Pitt plays the role. So for about an hour and a half, you're waiting for Brad Pitt to look like Brad Pitt. That is to say, supernaturally pretty. And then the next hour thinking, is that all there is? Because as pretty as his face is, it's not a very interesting face, and there is not a lot going on in it. I think people may be very moved by it. It's kind of a good soap opera, and he and Cate Blanchett look like a couple of Greek statues making love. But, you know, it's about the fleetingness of life, and it's 2 hours and 45 minutes. So it seems a bit of a contradiction in terms. The other movie that's very interesting is Revolutionary Road. It's an anti-suburbia drama, horrifically depressing, based on a great Richard Yates novel about a woman and a man who are trapped in their house, and she's going crazy, and he is drifting into conformity. What's interesting is that they're played by that fun couple from the Titanic, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. So this time the iceberg that they hit is middle-class 1950s American life. And folks, it sinks them. But she is incredible, and she pushes him into places that you've never seen him go. He's absolutely undefended in this movie. All the boyish charm flies out the window, and it's quite a spectacle to see, especially if you hated Titanic as much as I did.
Well, David, I want to thank you for looking at the year in film with us, and I wish you happy holidays and a very good and healthy 2009, with hopefully some good movies in it.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much, Terry.
David Edelstein is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for New York Magazine. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the director of a new film that's on our film critic David Edelstein's 10 Best list. Ari Folman's movie Waltz with Bashir is an animated documentary. Folman was a soldier in the Israeli army in 1982 when Israel invaded Lebanon with the plan of occupying a security zone in the south of Lebanon to stop Palestinian attacks against Israel's northern towns. Folman was one of the Israeli soldiers who surrounded the Sabra and Shatila Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon while members of the Christian Falangist militia went in and massacred the refugees. But Fulman had no specific memories of the 3 days of the massacre, and that gap haunted him. So he found some of his fellow former soldiers and interviewed them about their memories, hoping that would help his own memories emerge. The film features the audio of those interviews, but the images of the conversations, memories, and dreams are animated. Fulman also went into psychotherapy during the 4 years that he made Waltz with Bashir. On a related note, he was a writer on the Israeli TV show that was the basis of the HBO series about psychotherapy in treatment. Ari Fulman, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe your friend's dream that opens your movie?
Well, my friend had this repeating constant dream that he dreamt every night, or every morning, I might say, that 26 dogs are haunting him, rabid dogs, really savage dogs, are haunting him, running towards him in the streets of Tel Aviv. They want his head, and it took him some time to realize that they're after him since in the First Lebanon War, his job was to eliminate those dogs who were about to alert the Palestinian terrorists that the Israeli army was looking for.
So he had to kill the dogs so that the dogs didn't bark and alert the Palestinians.
This is it. And then they came back 20 years later in the dreams.
Mm-hmm. So what was it about that dream that made you wonder what your role was during the Lebanon War and where you were during the massacre at Sabra and Shatila refugee camps?
Well, the dream was so illustrative, you couldn't resist it as a filmmaker. You just saw it immediately animated on the screen. And then, of course, it, in many ways, it scratched my old scars that were deeply suppressed about my past, coming from my past, from my subconscious, from my deep suppressed subconscious from the First Lebanon War, and this is where it all started to roll.
Your friend pointed out to you that you were actually just a few hundred feet away from the massacre at the refugee camps during the First Lebanon War. Had you completely forgotten that?
No, we knew where we were, but I didn't, it's not that I went, you know, like you go through a car accident and you go through a major brain concussion and then you don't remember your name and who you are and where you come from. It's something completely different. It's that you have the main storyline, but there are some fragments missing. And I knew that I was there, but I mean, we didn't know anything, me at least, and some friends of mine, about the events that were going around and what part did we take in them. So the film is trying to figure that out.
The fact that you were really just a few hundred feet away from the massacres, even though you had no idea what was going on, you found this like very disturbing. Now, Americans aren't as familiar with what happened as Israelis are. So let me ask you before we go any further to just describe those massacres. Like what happened that day, those days?
Well, Lebanon was a very complex country. It had a few parties, most of them religious parties, and each one of them had a private army. Israel invaded Lebanon in June 1982 because the Israeli northern border was bombed by Palestinians, PLO army, during the summer. And Israel invaded Lebanon in order to prevent these bombs. And our allies in Lebanon were the Christians. They had their own army that was called the Falangist Militia. So we were kind of partners in this multi-party war of Lebanon. And then after a couple of months, Bashir Jumail, who was the adored leader of the Falangist, the Christian militia, was elected as president of Lebanon. But a couple of weeks later, his headquarters was bombed, and he died with all his chief of staff. The Falangist, his soldiers, as a revenge for his death, they marched into the refugee camps of the Palestinians, who were supposed to be the ones who killed Bashir, but they eventually it was found out that they didn't. It was the Syrians. Anyway, they marched into the camps and they did this massacre who took place for 72 hours, and they killed more than 3,200 Palestinians. Most of them were women and kids and old people. All of them were non-protected. And the fact that they did go into the camps was because they got the permission of the Israeli government to do it. Whether the government knew in advance what was going to happen or not, we don't know. What we know is that during the massacre, they got some information about what was going on, and no one from the government really did anything to stop it.
In the film, you portray yourself as being really haunted by the fact that you knew, you remembered being in close proximity of the massacre, but you couldn't really remember any details or what was going on. And you also had this, like, image that haunted you, and you couldn't figure out where that image came from. Were you, I guess I'm trying to figure out how much of the film is truly autobiographical and how much of it was kind of dramatized to make it a better movie.
It is totally autobiographical. The all the things that are told in the film are true. Mm-hmm. In the manner as much as documentary filmmaking can be true or objective. I mean, they're not, then it never is. You know, there's no one truth, especially when you go backwards 25 years in time and try to figure out in one event what really happened. So there are a lot of versions, but the fact that it was done, drawn, or animated, it doesn't make it less true in my mind, in my opinion.
To better understand where you were during the massacre, you talked to some of your former fellow soldiers, you tracked them down, and basically interviewed them about their memories of those days. And I'm wondering what your friends' reactions were when you told them that you wanted to do this and also that you wanted to make a movie about it.
Well, most of the people we approached in many ways were longing for just telling at last their war story. They were waiting for someone to listen. Because in Israeli society, the First Lebanon War is not that thing that you go around and speak about. There's nothing to be proud about. So in many ways, they wanted to do it. Some of them, weirdly enough, my best friends, didn't want to take part in the film, or at least they didn't want to expose themselves in the film. But, I mean, most of them did.
Tell us one of the stories that one of your friends told you about the massacre, about where they were during the massacre or during the war in Lebanon that brought back memories for you, that helped you reconstruct your own experience. One of those stories.
Well, I'll tell you something else. I now traveled with the film, and I read this article somewhere in a plane. I travel in the U.S. for 20 days now from city to city. And it was a story about a current American soldier in Iraq. And I read the story and I figured that it takes an American soldier to go back home from the front in Iraq 6 days, at least, to his home in, I don't know, Oklahoma, okay? And then I thought, for the first time, if I knew it while I was doing the film, if I would ever think about it, it would have been in the film. But now, of course, it's too late. I'm talking to you now. It's too late to change the film. But then I thought that for us, for example, it took 20 minutes to go from Beirut, from the front, from hell, literally hell, back home to Haifa in a helicopter. So just imagine the transformation you have to go through in 20 minutes, coming from, I mean, the middle of hell, destruction, death everywhere, going to this live city, everybody's like having parties in 20 minutes' time. Can you imagine that?
You know, it's funny because I thought of Iraq too. I thought of the war in Iraq during a scene in your film that's about you taking a furlough and you come home. And like you said, you know, everything's like business as usual in Israel. Like there's like the punks and the disco and people are shopping. And And you are feeling totally disconnected from everything around you. It makes no sense to you. And you remember growing up that when there were wars, that everything stopped in Israel. People were afraid to go out. Give us a sense of what that was like when you were a boy and Israel was at war.
Well, I experienced only one war as a boy, as a child, as a 10-year-old kid. And I remember that everything stopped in life.
Which war was this?
It was the Yom Kippur War in 1973. I was 10 years old then, and, you know, there was nothing but war everywhere. We were kids in school. This is what we talked about. We were hooked to the news, and we didn't have TV set at home back then, but on the radio all day. We couldn't, you know, in nighttime we couldn't put the light on because we were frightened that Syrian aircraft are going to come and bomb Haifa. And this was it. And the grief of the families of the dead was everywhere in every neighborhood. It stuck in every neighborhood. There was someone that didn't come back from the war. And it was depressing. Everything was really depressing. As kids, we saw the elder people, they were all deeply depressed. And then, only 8 years later, it's not a long time, I came back home as a soldier 9 years later. And no one gave a damn, except my parents, of course. No one. Everybody was partying big time. The 80s culture came from Europe. It was really strong in terms of music and drugs and everything, so it was quite shocking.
And what did that make you feel about the war that you were fighting and how you were risking your life to do it?
Well, it didn't take me time to realize. It took me just a few hours to realize that it's a total waste of time and a useless idea, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing there.
What do you remember now about where you were during the massacre at Sabra and Shatila?
Well, it's what you see in the film. We were something like 300 yards, or five, or half a kilometer, I would say, from the camps, and on a roof of a building, and that's it. We were lighting the sky because this is the orders that we were given.
You were shooting up flares to light things up.
We were shooting out flares, yeah, to light things up.
And what you didn't understand then is that you were lighting things up for the Christian phalangists who were committing the massacre. But you had no idea that that's what you were...
2 days later, we already had the idea.
We knew the idea.
Not while we were doing it, of course, but... After the massacre ended and we realized that there was a massacre, we realized what was going on during all those 3 days, of course.
So what have the difficulties been for you of kind of coming to terms for that, that you unknowingly aided in some way with the flares, an act that you found so reprehensible?
This is what suppression is all about.
Suppression of memory.
Yeah. Maybe. Some things in life are too difficult to deal with, so you just suppress it.
My guest is Ari Folman. His new movie, Waltz with Bashir, is an animated documentary. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ari Folman. His new movie, Waltz with Bashir, is an animated documentary about trying to reconstruct his suppressed memories of being one of the Israeli soldiers that invaded Lebanon in 1982. One of the things that I think is really very effective in the movie is that it's animated. So instead of just watching you interview your friends about their memories of the war and you sharing your own, the conversations are all animated. And within those conversations, we see it's what's going on in people's minds is animated. The experiences that they're recounting to you are animated. Their dreams are animated. And it made me think about what a good medium animation is for getting into somebody's inner life, for getting into their dreams and memories. Is that why you chose animation?
Completely. You just answered the question completely. I couldn't do it better. I couldn't answer it better. Why animation? You summed it up.
Had you thought of doing it any other way, or did you know right from the start this needed to be animated?
No, it couldn't be done any other way. The only way to go from one dimension to another, from dreams to reality, would be in animation.
And then how did you figure out what kind of animation you wanted to do? I mean, for instance, there's the parts that are supposed to be real as opposed to, like, you know, dreams look very real, but they're not the technique that's called rotoscope, where you're basically coloring over a video or a film, and that's why it looks so perfectly realistic, like in the movie Waking Life. That's not what you've done. What did you do? Like, what is the form of animation, and how did you decide on that?
Well, the basic animation is cutout animation, it's flash animation. And this is the main animation of the film, and it was dictated mainly by the design of the film, which we tried to do as realistic as we could. The design, that means putting more details, more contours, more wrinkles, just realistic, because I was obsessed with the fact that I thought that the audience can be only emotionally connected to the characters only if it's really realistically looking. And then there is the secondary style of design, which is for the dream sequences, much more free in terms of colors and proportion and everything. They got more freedom there. And then there's the hardcore documentary thing, which is much more strict. It's monochromatic between orange and black. And it takes you really to the end of the film. It's much more melancholic in atmosphere and depressing.
Yeah, at the end of the film, you show actual documentary footage from after the massacre at the refugee camps. And, you know, you've been so drawn up into this point in the animation, and the animation has established its own reality, and suddenly you're thrust into the genuine reality, the real footage. And it's just kind of, you're unprepared for it, and the images are so shocking to begin with. But re-entering the world of real images after the animated images maybe makes it even more so. Can you talk about your decision to show real documentary footage of the results of the massacre at the end of the film?
Well, it's more of an ideological decision than an artistic decision. And it is there just to prevent a situation that someone will walk out of the theater after having watched this film and think it's a very cool anti-war animated film. It shows you exactly what happened in those 50 seconds. And I think it puts the whole film in proportion. It puts my story in proportion. It puts memory in proportion. It shows you in many ways what wars look like.
And why you're so haunted by it.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did the experience of the war in Lebanon change your idea of the Israeli military and war and Israeli foreign policy?
Well, it's not like that. It's much more radical than that. It made me a pacifist. And I just don't believe in any kind of war. It's not just like this justified war and not justified war. I'm totally against violence. And I do think that, okay, wars can be prevented with compromises you have to do in diplomacy and politics. And I mean, mainly I think that it's all the same stuff. I mean, they're all made the same way. It's like a cliche. It's like a Bob Dylan song. It's those leaders disconnected with big egos that they don't mind sending young people to die on a foreign land. I don't know for what. For land, for a piece of land, for religious ideology. It doesn't matter. It's all the same for me.
I'm sure what a lot of Israelis would say, that Israel is surrounded by hostile countries, and unless Israel is willing to fight, it will cease to exist.
Well, I won't argue with them.
You won't argue with that?
No, I don't argue with those people. You know, we have different opinions.
My guest is Ari Folman. His new movie, Waltz with Bashir, is an animated documentary. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ari Folman. His new movie, Waltz with Bashir, is an animated documentary about trying to reconstruct his suppressed memories of being one of the Israeli soldiers that invaded Lebanon in 1982. Your movie, Waltz with Bashir, has shown at film festivals. It's already opened in Israel. It's about to open in the United States. Have you been getting different reactions in different countries?
Yes, definitely.
Can you tell us about some of the differences?
Well, I think in many ways the reaction towards the film reflect the country's history and problems from the past that still haunting the countries. I mean, in France, where it was an enormous success and more than 500,000 people came to see it in theaters, for them it was all about guilt feelings, the film. This is how they saw the film. And it had a lot to do with their past in Algeria. No matter what you say or don't say, for them it's all about guilt. For the Germans, it was all about the massacre, of course, and about the comparison with the Holocaust. And eventually, when this is how the press turned out, they didn't come to see the film because they don't want to do anything that has to do with their past, of course. In England, it was a great success, but in England, they just treated it as an artistic issue, as an invention in filmmaking, and it was about arts, which is great, in my opinion. In Bosnia, where I had the best screening of the film, it related to the war in Yugoslavia 13 years ago in Europe, so it was very emotional for them, all the screenings. So every place it's different.
What made the screening in Bosnia that you went to the best of the screenings?
It was the most emotional screening. I mean, for people in Sarajevo, where it took place, it's just, and they went through the Srebrenica massacre in the mid-90s. The whole event, you know, immediately emerged memories not from very long ago of their past. It was very emotional, very emotional. Huge screening, open space, at night, more than 4,000 people. It was amazing.
I'd like you to leave us with an image from your movie, Waltz with Bashir, and it's the image that the title of the film is taken from. Can you describe that image as it's described to you in the film?
Well, in the film, there's this guy that in the middle of battle, he loses it, you might say. And there is this one junction in Beirut that all the soldiers have to cross. And it's being shot at by snipers that you can't see. They're on those huge hotels all over around. And it takes hours to cross the junction. And you have to do it as fast as you can just to survive. And this guy grabs someone else's machine gun and he runs into the junction and he starts firing like crazy and he starts dancing between the bullets. And I don't know if he was there for 10 seconds, 1 minute, 2 minutes. It doesn't matter. I mean, the time he stayed there was so risky, so it looked like eternity. So this is the title of the film, Waltz with Bashir. And the other meaning of the title is symbolic meaning, and this is the relationship between the Israelis and their allies, the Christian militia, that was kind of a dance we did with them that ended up in a very tragic way.
And the Bashir Jamal, who was the head
yes.
of the Christian yeah. phalangist militia, and as the person, as the soldier you're describing, is just, you know, circling and circling, shooting at whatever. That waltz that you described, there's pictures of Bashir Jamal all around him.
Yeah.
Well, Ari Folman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ari Folman directed the new animated documentary, Waltz with Bashir.